And that's going on in the days of the apostles. But like I said, they're not writing it down. It's secret, you know? And it's this oral tradition process. Well, just like the Mishnah wasn't written down, and then later was, so too the mysticism starts getting written down in later centuries. And so you have I'm just going to run through these really quickly now. We have a Talmudic era book, books called Hekalot. What are Hekalot? Palaces. These are redactions of the apocalypses. Because the idea is that you ascended, these people ascended into the heavenly palaces. What did they see? And so these, the Hekalot literature is kind of the foundation of Kabbalah. This is where we're starting the Kabbalah, okay? And all it is old apocalypses warmed over. Basically, that's what's going on with it. Sefer Yetzirah. We don't know where this book comes from or when it was written. According to legend, it was written by Abraham. Sefer Yetzirah means book of formation. What is it? It wasn't written by Abraham for sure, but what is it? It's a book of letters and numbers and about how Hebrew letters work together and make numbers and names of God and adding up the numbers and how these numbers combine with these letters and these letters combine with these numbers and this sort of thing, in order to create the universe. There's different combinations of things. You can make, you know, and if you, apparently if you know what you're doing, you can make a cow. Now, I don't know. I read something about that once, about Rabbi Yehuda needed something for Sabbath dinner, so he made a cow. Well, I don't know. Sefer Yetzirah is... And it has information about these emanations, and this is the—I believe this is where the Sefirot, the whole idea of the ten Sefirot of God, comes from. And as I look at this, what it looks like to me is a Jewish response to Gnosticism, which is a whole other lecture. But Gnosticism at this time in the 2nd century and 3rd century, Gnosticism had almost taken over Christianity. Christianity was almost completely lost, destroyed by a mystical movement called Gnosticism. And Gnosticism began to also erode Jewish monotheism. And so the mystics needed to reply to Gnosticism. And it looks to me like Sefer Yetzirah and a lot of Jewish mysticism is an attempt to answer Gnosticism and say, no, God made the world, and it is good. He's good, and the world is good. Because, of course, Gnosticism was saying just the opposite of both of those premises. All right, so that's how I would understand Sefer Yetzirah. Now let's talk about the Zohar. This is the Zohar, right here. One volume of it. See? It's all Aramaic. The rest is up there on that top shelf. You see this same color of book? Right? Okay, so it's a rather large work. This has a lot of commentary. This particular edition has a lot. This is all commentary down here. This is actually our text up on the top. It's Aramaic. And all this commentary down here. So this particular edition spreads out a lot. This is Sansino's English edition, the very first English edition of the Zohar, which it's not obviously not so big. It skips a lot, though. It's missing sections. But, you know, I like it. What is the Zohar? Well, the Zohar was written in the 2nd century or the 13th century. It's up to you. In other words, it's probably a forgery. It's supposed to be written by Shimon ben Yochai, the guy who hid in the cave with his son from the Romans. They hid in the cave for several years, and they only wore their clothes on Sabbath, and the rest of the time they buried themselves in the sand and studied Torah all day. Remember that story? Okay. Well, they didn't want their clothes to wear out. And God sent and made a fig tree and a carob tree and a spring. And so that guy, all right. Well, he had nothing to do while he was there living in the cave. And he had a lot of mystical ideas and learned a lot of mystical things. And so he remembered all these conversations with his colleagues that he had had with his colleagues, all these mystical conversations with his colleagues. He wrote it all down. It's the Zohar. And nobody ever saw this book until the 13th century when a Spanish rabbi named Moses de Leon published it. I don't know where he got it, but most scholars believe he wrote it. He made it up. It's a forgery. It's, you know, it's, I don't know. There's a, if you're Orthodox Jew, it's absolutely the work of Shimon ben Yochai. It's from the second century. You can't talk about it. I mean, it's like fundamentalists, you know. The Zohar says it, I believe it, and that settles it. It's true and inerrant, and I stand upon the, you know, like that. Outside of that, the rest of Judaism is a little bit more cynical about it, outside of that Orthodox opinion. Nevertheless, everybody agrees that even if Moses de Leon made it up, he didn't make it up out of, as they say, whole cloth. Instead, he is incorporating all sorts of older mystical traditions and mystical material and earlier books, earlier writings. I mean, I read the Zohar, I say, oh, that's in the Talmud. Oh, that's in the Midrash. Oh, I've seen that elsewhere. You know, it's like page after page after page. But he gives everything a kind of a different spin, or the Zohar gives everything a little bit of a different spin. Here's how Paul Levertov summarizes it. The situation. He says, in its present form, the Zohar first appeared in Spain in the 13th century, while purporting to be but a commentary on the Torah, on the Pentateuch. It is in reality a thesaurus of mystic contemplations on the divine transcendence and immanence, on creation and redemption, on God and Israel, on Israel and the world, on this world and the world to come, on holiness and the other side, that is, sin, on sin and on life and death, on paradise and hell. It is written in Aramaic and is ascribed to the 2nd century Galilean Shimon ben Yochai. I think it's pretty great. Here's how it goes. Almost every one of the episodes in the Zohar begin with two rabbis walking on a road. They're walking on a road, and they're walking along, and one of them says, hey, let's talk some mystical stuff. And so they start saying, hey, what do you think about this verse? And so then the rabbi says, you know, he goes on for several pages. And then the other one says, oh, yeah, but did you think of this? And he goes on for several pages. And then a third rabbi walks up and they don't know he's a rabbi. Maybe he's the guy driving the donkey. Maybe he's the guy driving the cart. Or he just is a stranger that appears. And the third guy comes up and he says, I couldn't help but overhear you guys talking, but have you considered this? And he just turns the whole thing over and goes, and then they go, whoa! That just blew my mind. And then he usually like ascends or something like that. That third guy like turns out to be an angel or turns out to be, you know, some other like, whoa, I know who you are. You're, you know, some super rabbi from past generations, or it's Elijah or something, you know, like this. All right, so you should recognize the form. This is the Emmaus Road. It's the story of the two disciples on the Emmaus Road when the stranger comes up, starts talking to them, and it says that he opens their mind so they could understand the scriptures, and he explains to this is, so you have the story of the Emmaus Road over and over and over, and it's called the Zohar. It's kind of funny. It makes me think that that must have been like just a classic text type setup for a mystical dissertation. that in this kind of literature. So that's what the Zohar is. I will read you Olga Levertov's description of the Zohar. This is, by the way, this is a great little book. This is a commentary on love in the Messianic Age. I don't know if you've seen it before. Me and some of my colleagues put this together, and we just threw a whole bunch of junk in here. Good junk. This is Olga Levertov's explanation of the Zohar. I'm going to read it to you because I believe that her dad wrote this for her. This is from her book, The Wailing Wall. She says, the Zohar, or brightness, is the most important mystical work produced by Jewry in the Middle Ages. The Zohar influenced profoundly the mystical thought of future generations. It was also known to Christian scholars of the period and was a mine of theosophical and Gnostic-styled lore, as well as weird and pseudo-scientific ideas about astronomy, astrology, physiognomy, and other ingenuities. Purporting to be the work of Shimon ben Yochai, a second-century rabbi, it was supposed to have been discovered by Moses de Leon in the 13th century, who later asserted he had written it himself, or later admitted he had written it himself. It's debated whether he admitted it or not. But in reality, it is quite obviously the work of many authors. Much of the material goes back, in all probability, to a very early date, perhaps indeed to the second or even the first century, but its sources and its authors lie buried in the past, and its whole history is wrapped in obscurity. It is a literary curiosity, a historical enigma. Homeschool kid, Olga Levertov. Its style is cryptic to the point of being perfectly incomprehensible. It purports to be a commentary on the Torah. So it is, but not in the least a commentary on the Torah as we read it. Every word and syllable, every phrase and incident has an inner supernal meaning, and these meanings build up to a sort of code of imagination and airy structure on quite a different plane of reality, and everything is twisted out of its mundane context in order that it may yield a supernal implication. The book is therefore not the slightest use as a commentary on the Torah, but as a guide to the intricacies of Jewish mystical thought, as a signpost to a strange dream country, which has its own solidity and its own verities, which in time one comes to recognize with a sort of familiarity. As such a pointer, the Zohar is extraordinarily illuminating. It is written mostly in Aramaic, in a kind of cryptic, abbreviated, illusory style which resembles nothing so much as a sort of supernal shorthand. I thought that was the best description of the Zohar, better than I could say it in that many words. So that's why I read that for you. Okay, so that's the Zohar. Now we need to, I'm going to wrap this up. We need to talk about Svat a little bit. Anybody know what Svat is? Have you ever seen it? Been there? All right, so here you, if we're down in the Galilee, where, you know, where the Master is always walking around, there's a big hill up to the north of Lake Galilee, and on this hill sits the village of Svat. So this is a village the Master would have definitely visited in his trips around the Galilee. And some people like to say, a city on a hill cannot be hidden in regard to Svat, because that would be the Galilean city on the hill. In 1492, other than Columbus, what happened? Right, we had the Spanish expulsion of the Jewish people. So Ferdinand and Isabella, under their watch, expelled all Spanish Jews, and it was one of the great upsets of the Jewish world, of Jewish history. Huge loss of property, migration, refugee situation, Inquisition, forced conversions, on and on and on. Anyway, several refugees ended up saying, well, hey, let's go to the Holy Land. And they settled in Svat. And these were some great rabbis, brilliant, brilliant minds and mystical thinkers. And so Svat became a center of mysticism, and it still is to this day, center of mysticism in the land of Israel. So you have this Sephardic colony of Jews, and they're focused primarily on what can we do to bring Messiah. Because this situation is terrible. We're constantly being thrown out of one country, then thrown out of another country. We need to bring an end to the exile. And so they start basically a think tank to bring an end to the exile and bring Messiah. And so this is their whole idea, their whole thrust and emphasis is about bringing Messiah and bringing the kingdom. And so you'll recognize some of these names if you do any studying in Jewish mysticism. This is where Moses Cordovero was at, Moshe Alshik. I use his commentaries in some of my work. This guy, Shlomo Alkabetz, wrote the song that we sing on Friday nights, Lekah Dodi. And then, of course, most famous of all, Isaac Luria. Isaac Luria, also called the Lion, or Ha'ari HaKodesh, or also called the Arizal, all these different names. And his disciples, Chaim Vital. And these I'm just throwing these at you really quick. You don't have to know anything about them, except that if you're ever reading mysticism, these names are going to be popping up all the time. So, for example, you're reading Levertov, you're going to be bumping into these names. Speaking of Levertov, we'll leave the Sfat rabbis. Here's an interesting thing about Levertov. When Socino decided to translate this, the Aramaic Zohar, into English, they found it very daunting, difficult to do. And they didn't have, they hired the best Jewish scholars they could to do it, but they hit a snag and couldn't do it. They ended up having to call on Paul Levertov to help them out. So Paul Levertov says, well, sure, I'd be happy to help you translate the Zohar, right? I said, well, that's great. Would it be okay if we just didn't put your name on it? And the reason being, of course, that he's a famous believer and Messianic Jew, who was trying to start this Messianic Jewish movement. So Paul Levertov says, no, that wouldn't be all right at all. You got to put my name on it. Well, they went back and forth, and finally they put his name, but they didn't list him. They listed him with other authors. So it doesn't seem like he's the exclusive translator, but the truth is he is the exclusive translator of Exodus in the Zohar, and big chunks of the rest as well. He did work with the team. So he, because of that, he has a pretty great perspective on the Zohar. And it's actually shocking. I'm going to read you the passage from his writings. Oh, this is too long to read to you. All right, this is... It's what I would call one long, breathless passage. I mean, it's like there's actually... I think I broke this up and put in some periods here and there when I was... This is from... Paul Levertov used to write a journal called The Church and the Jews. And... I mean, they've all been lost. They came out every month. Toby found online a seminary library that had a stash of them. And so we sent him to a city to find these things, and he went and scanned them all. That's why we have so much information on Levertov. He rescued all these journals. He didn't get them all, but he got probably a decade worth of these. So this is from Church and the Jews. Someday I'm going to put it all together. I'm going to pile it up. Levertov writes, the final aim and all-pervading theme of the whole Zohar, and the reason at the back of the whole order of its philosophy, is the desire to effect and complete the unity of all things in one volume of glory and perfection, union of the different aspects of the divine personality, union of the two ultimate aspects of the universe, justice and mercy, union of the celestial and terrestrial spheres, union of God and man. But whereas in too many modern minds, too great stress is laid upon this last unifying intent in its subjective aspect, in the minds of the unknown spiritual artist whose testament and apologia is the Zohar, even the mystical ideal of fusion with the divine is subject to and but a part of the yet higher aim of glorifying ever more perfect, more perfectly the divine itself. Thus man becomes at once more humble and more noble, an instrument only, but actually an instrument with the power to exalt and aid the splendor of the majesty of the Most High. No theory of worship can approach this in its dignity, its objectivity, its stupendous simplicity. There is no room here for mere emotional satisfaction, self-glorification, or cold righteousness. Everything glows and burns with the bright, steady flame of self-forgetful ecstasy, of will concentrated fiercely on one point and to one end, of heart subdued by the discipline of the spirit until the point is reached where the suppliant becomes the giver and the co-operator, the partaker of delight, one with the celestial life of praise. Has heaven begun while yet here on earth, this world being but a prefiguring of what is above, man but a lesser copy of angels, his world a lesser heaven, or, if he will it so, a lesser Gehenna, if he choose it to be ruled by those principalities of evil, the rulers of the other side, who are yet themselves within the Creator's scheme, being lords of judgment, by whose accusations the self-destroyed soul may be duly punished, though even for such there is some final hope. In this all-embracing scheme of life, whose universe, being at once limitless and God-created, must of necessity include all things in the gigantic sweep of divine intention, the incomprehensible is not caged, nor is poetry tied down into bundles of formalism, but perhaps because of the long silent watches of mystical contemplation which at last receive their reward in this wise, for at present there is indeed an appearance as of separation between the Creator and his creation, only because the scum of wickedness which as yet still clings to the hem of the garment of righteousness. And therefore, although even in this time we proclaim the unity of God, we do so silently. But in the time that is to be when the Messiah will reign and sin be banished, then shall that unity be proclaimed openly. That was a quotation. The divine somehow comes down from some unremarked moment into simple ways of men and is found in their midst and becomes familiar and comprehensible at last. And what of wealth, what wealth of Christward implication could one find in interpretation of the Zohar in the light of messianic fulfillment? Then he goes on in another article and makes what I think is kind of a shocking statement. Listen to this. He says, if Christians could but attain to a vision of the essence and core of their own faith, of 1,000th the intensity wherewith those Zoharatic rabbis plumbed the depths and scales and heights of infinitude, then they might become more worthy of their title, Christians, and even show to others a worthier, more thrilling, less man-exalting path to more distant but, oh, more glittering and lightful stars. How petty, how earthbound, how much a clod the Zohar makes one feel. Undoubtedly, the vision and the ardor which crams its tantalizing pages hardly needs refocusing with Christ at its center to make it a veritable Bible, not only of Jewish, but of Christian, and above all, Hebrew Christian mystics, or to use our terminology, Messianic Jewish mystics. And what mystics ought not they to be? That's Paul Levitan on the Zohar. All right, so let's sum this up now. We've come through this. What is the value of studying Jewish mysticism? I don't recommend it. not till you're 50.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's that fine line between turning 50 and then forgetting what you just read.
Yeah, all right. Maybe that's
what. That's probably why they're letting you do it.
Yeah, probably. Probably. The Vatican recognized in Kabbalistic literature and the Zohar such extreme value in understanding New Testament that they commissioned their own translations into Latin. You know, so you study Jewish mysticism, you don't get very far. You don't get more than a few paragraphs when you're that like, whoa, that's in the New Testament. Whoa, now I understand what's in the New Testament. These sorts of things start clicking really quickly. So there's obviously a great value in studying Jewish mysticism, but at the same time, you need to be very, very, very well grounded. It's a dark, it's like a dark, dangerous city at night with lots of twisting alleys and narrow, you know, escapes and bad neighborhoods, and you don't even have a map. You know, you don't know where you are. You've just been dropped into the middle of this. You know, it's like you feel uncomfortable. This is what it's like. So, you know, if you're interested, I recommend you study it through something like Paul Levertov and his work. You know, Kabbalah is a vast genre of literature. Like I said, it's not one book. There's bad stuff. There's good stuff. How do you know the difference? You know? Another problem with the Kabbalistic approach, and this is true of all mystical approaches, is it's highly allegorical. It's the sod, or it's someone's idea of what the sod of the scripture is. It's not which doesn't necessarily make it the sod. It makes it what someone said the sod was. You know what I mean? And the problem with allegory is you lose the literal meaning of the Bible. You get so swept up in these allegorical interpretations that soon the Bible doesn't mean what it says anymore. Your brain is off going, you know, doing these like cartwheels over here. So there's a danger along with that. This is why, you know, you need to like have Rashi pull you back down to earth, I guess, if you study some mysticism. He'll pull you back into the Peshat. Certainly there's questionable elements. I mentioned the superstitions before, that there's a lot of superstition. Lots and lots of Eastern European superstition is woven through it. And you have to be able to like recognize that. But you also have to... There's more than just superstition in mystical literature. There's some really, really crazy... Well, I don't know if it's crazy or not. I mean, everything you believe in religion is crazy. I mean, who are we to say, well, that's crazy, you know? It's like... I mean, like, what do we believe that's not crazy? But from an Orthodox point of view, and I mean an Orthodox Christian point of view, it's troubling to talk about things like the transmigration of souls, okay? Which is basically a form of reincarnation, teaching, you know, a form of reincarnation. We find these sorts of things going on in mystical literature, in Jewish mysticism. You know, these are people... rabbis who are trying to grasp with these questions of the soul and how does the soul interface with the body and this sort of thing and life and death and rebirth and the resurrection, these sorts of questions. And so transmigration, I would say, oh, there's a problem. You know, the apostles say it is appointed to man to die once, right? Then there's you know, what you could consider occultic elements. And by occultic, I mean, you know, recognize, maybe, spiritism at points.
Yeah.
in some of it. And so this is dangerous. You know, now we're I've never seen it. I've heard, I do hear tell. I've never seen anything like that ever in mystical literature, except for warnings about evil spirits and that sort of thing. But I've heard, and not from reputable sources, that, and there probably is, who knows. Finally, Paul's warning. Maybe we should just read that to close. This is Colossians 2. And verse 18. No, yes. 2:18. Paul says, "Let no one keep defrauding you of your prize by delighting in asceticism and the worship of angels, taking his stand on visions that he has seen, inflated without cause by his fleshly mind, and not holding fast to the head, from whom the entire body, being supplied and held together by joints and ligaments, grows with the growth which is from God." So Paul, in his day, was dealing with mystics. Mystics that he felt were going in the wrong direction. And that would certainly be, you know, that's certainly a fair warning for studying mysticism. So, yeah, I don't really recommend it.